Okay, good. So let's start with these slides. You know, let's go to slide 2 right away. Are we on slide 2?
Everybody can hear you. I think at least I can hear you just fine. So just keep from time to time note which slide number you're on, Madhu.
You're on slide 2 now. Now everybody would be happy to know that USC here in Los Angeles has a astronautical engineering department that is separate from the aerospace and mechanical engineering department. And we focus on spacecraft engineering and mission design. And if you look at the syllabus, you'll see that several courses differ from what is offered in the aerospace and mechanical engineering department. If you look at the 10-year anniversary brochure from 2014, I think, you can Google it. You'll see the range of programs and projects that are going on there. Mike Gruntman is the chair, current chair, and the nicest thing about the courses offered in this program is that most of the classes can be taken over the distance education network. I know many universities do this. Now, and USC has been a leader in this for many, many years. And our astronautic engineering curriculum is widely disseminated all over the U.S. and also elsewhere. So it's something you all want to take a look at. Going to slide 3. One of the courses that we have there is the one that I teach. It's called the Space Concept Studio. I think it's listed as ASTE 527, and the term is space architecting. And I'm hearing a little bit of an echo on the phone. Is that okay?
Sometimes that appears. Right now, it seems to have gone away.
Oh, good. All right. So now, so this elective is a 3-unit elective, and it's been running long before we became a department, and used to be in the AME department. Now it is very, very specially.
Why, Madhu? Okay, somebody's got what sounds like my apologies, Madhu. It sounds like somebody's got an open mic, but now I think he or she is muted again. Okay. Let's proceed. Thanks, Madhu.
Thanks. So it's been going on for about two decades, and we usually get anywhere between 9 and 12 students, and they hail, at least half of them hail from all over the country. Many are from the industry, and they come in for an evening lecture and tutorial. And as I mentioned, it's a dial-in class. You dial in, and you don't have to come to the campus at all. In fact, for many of the courses offered in the EASD department, and you take the 3-unit class, and you do well, you receive 3 units of credit. And this particular class focuses on creative ideas. We are interested in things that can be but have not been articulated in the literature. So basically, we are looking for original ideas. And I keep stressing them because engineering artifacts tend to be touch and feely things. We have to become visual at some point in time and be graphic. And I keep telling them, you don't have to be worried about being correct, because many times, many, many correct designs and architectures never see the day of light. So don't worry about that part. But, you know, be sure that you have an idea, right or wrong. So we've been there since 1993, and it's a design studio. we use some of the tools that are employed in the School of Architecture to make the. So there is no time in the 15 weeks to really crank out the engineering analysis that should follow, because that would be in the other fine classes that the department offers. We have some very nice classes in engineering analysis, spacecraft systems that Mike Gruntman teaches, and so on. So why do we do this? Only because we think that concepts help planners to make choices between different possible options. It may or may not work, but it surely broadens. It surely broadens. 1 minute, please. Lapa, I'm on lecture now. So, sorry about that. So now it expands your worldview about what kind of ideas are possible, and that is the main theme of our class. So, what do? We borrow from other professions that deal with what we call wicked problems. All of you know what wicked problems are. Essentially, they are problems that don't have a very clear solution, but you can tackle them by introducing new parameters. Sometimes it works, and so that we call that solving a problem out of bounds. That is introducing new parameters, and in our case, in the space industry, we don't need to introduce them because the space world is so dynamic and things are changing so fast. All you need to do is show new connections and bring in associative logic where you say that something is like so, therefore we can use that that particular idea for our case too, and so on. We bring in case studies. We get lectures from very creative professionals like many who are listed in the FISO list. And as you all know, it's an iterative process. You continue to do this until you get something that seems credible. So in essence, we are looking at a course that deals with creativity. It's actually a sandbox, if you want to think about it. And the closest thing that I can think of happens in the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. I think you know that writers get together and make up some of the greatest stories at that workshop. And so our plan is also something like that. But how far we succeed is, of course, up to the beholder. So what we do is we have a 15 weeks course. I mean, that's a semester long. Sometime during the middle of the class, we have a midterm where the participant will produce or articulate an idea he or she has had and brought to the class. And that kind of gives them an idea what is expected out of the concept. In the final team project, we have one theme, and everybody works around that. It's not a system study, but just a theme, and each of the participants get to pick an idea that will work within that theme. We get NASA lecturers and reviewers, and we are off to slide 5 now. Now, if you click on that site, Google site, you'll see some of the projects that have been done there, and you can see that we have looked at several years. We looked at lunar missions. We looked at Mars. We have also looked at the International Space Station and the future of the International Space Station. Please go on that site and take a look at some of the ideas that we have thought about. But you will see in there that most of it, in fact, all of it is related to human spaceflight in general. And you know, we have some very interesting people come and visit the class and talk to them. Buzz Aldrin is a good friend of the studio. He walks in unannounced from time to time. And as you know, he's very creative with some of his ideas. We're going to slide six now. Now, a little bit of history about the way I perceive the human spaceflight program. You know, you can go back into the early days of the space program, early 1960s, while the Mercury Gemini program was going on, and everybody talked about evolutionary development. And the reason is simple, because you need hard engineering data fed back to make new engineering models worthwhile and credible. Now, there was an office called the Office of Long Range Planning that many of you may know about. And Jesko von Puttkamer was leading that group. And he used to draw up some very cool visuals on what how you intended to go step by step to build up the space infrastructure. Here is an image that is way back, you know, I think it's from 1990 or something like that, that shows you that, you know, we had the idea that we'd go from LEO to GEO to Moon to Mars. And when you look at that, you still see the truth of the fact, which is that we are still building up. And approximate dates from this early 1990s chart is still very clear. That's where we are headed. We are slowly moving from the International Space Station arena to the lunar area. And then with that, all that experience, we plan to move to Mars. As you know, during the von Braun debates, I think Hubble suggested the lunar orbit rendezvous. It's around that time, too, that Esko was a proponent for Earth orbit rendezvous. And his debate, again, centered on this particular plan, which said if we evolve, step up one after the other from LEO to GEO to the Moon, we will have a sturdy and resilient structure as opposed to conducting something far out and then falling back on nothing. So that's an interesting debate that you may like to study for those who are listening in and interested in the history of human spaceflight. Slide 7. So what about the ISS future? Now, there is some discussion that they want to close it down by 2024, decommission it, and perhaps deorbit it. There is a group that thinks we have to form an ISS consortium. And there are some people who believe that it could be sent to the Moon. And some alternatives are like bring more partners into the program. Perhaps that is what the new administration will think of doing. Turn it over to private sector is another idea. And my favorite one is if the systems are so broken and cannot be relied upon, we should preserve it as a historical artifact. Park it in high orbit, or at least consider disassembling it and bringing back to the Smithsonian. Because these are expensive propositions, but, you know, space needs to have a solid concrete footing on history. After all, the Smithsonian Museum is the most visited museum on planet Earth. So now, when you look at the history of stations, specifically of station, you will realize that the original purpose was to use it as a spacecraft integration platform. And the reason is simple. We can only throw so much into orbit, and then we need to make bigger spacecraft. And the only way to do that is to have a station where we can do these kinds of things. Now, Associate Administrator Bill Gerstenmaier thinks that we could repurpose the station and perhaps even use certain parts of it to go out outside of the Earth orbit and perhaps to the moon and so on. And it's an idea that's been talked about many times. And so there are things to be thought about. Of course, commercial use is also possible, as I mentioned in the last slide. Now, in 1988, the International Space University gathered at MIT. And yours truly proposed an idea called MALEO, Module Assembly in Low Earth Orbit, that was really based on the idea that using the International Space Station, you can assemble different things and fly them off to the moon. And there were several advantages to doing that. You should probably take a look at the paper that was published then. USC has done several thoughts about that. In the ISS reports, slides that you'll see on that site. In fact, we spent 2 years looking at evolution of ISS, and hopefully some of you will go in there and take a look at those look at that site. When I look at those, I see two or three ideas that have to deal with what we're going to be talking about today. One is called the International Space Transit Vehicle that was proposed and presented as a paper. And Cosmic Mariner is also a similar idea to what we are about to talk about today. And there, all those slides are there, and you can pull up the papers, too, from the AIAA archives. So, essentially, the ISS was the idea of spacecraft integration platform and has a long and varied history, and it's one that we cannot neglect. You all know the fate of the space exploration initiative that happened under Bush senior administration. But then again, there they proposed the idea of using space station to build things. We are now on slide 10. And you'll see that some of the ideas that have been proposed in the SEI program that clearly show the capability of the ISS to build and float very large structures. Like so, slide 11. Now we're going to go to slide 12. Now here are one or two pictures of my project that did the same, which is to use the International Space Station to build a lunar base. And the main reason was that we would circumvent a lot of tools and systems that would otherwise be necessary on the lunar surface if we were to build a large spacecraft at the space station or in its proximity and then float it via special propulsion systems all the way to the moon. And this idea is still floating around because in the Mexico conference, the IAC conference, this slide is from that conference, which suggests that there are new technologies that make it even more possible for a variation of Earth orbit rendezvous and doing things on Earth orbit to fly off missions to further destinations. Arthur Clarke and Buzz Aldrin had some very interesting things to say about this idea of MALEO, and hopefully you will look at NASA has the paper on their server. Slide 13. So when you look at these spacecraft, what the philosophy that comes through is very clear. That is, large rockets are inevitable. Large spacecraft are also inevitable. When you say large, you're talking the same area that the space launch system capability is offering us, about to offer us. You know, with the SLS backbone, you can build and fly very large spacecraft. When you say very large, large, big, what does it mean? I'm talking 150 to 200 metric ton orbital vehicles. So, and to look at it even more interestingly, look at what the private space sector is doing. SpaceX, Blue Origin are all looking at very large launchers and spacecraft. And the reason is simple. I mean, the payload mass fraction improves, and you can obviously there is a benefit to the economics. We are in slide 14. Here you see a large spacecraft, the Malio, being assembled near in the proximity of the International Space Station. And I put in a beautiful Dragon spacecraft, and you can even see crew in there working on such a spacecraft. Slide 15 shows Malio about to land. When it touches down, it'll be a initial operational capability base, with a module for habitation, another module for power, and a third module as a lab, and while they go about conducting business. So now, some of the projects that happened that talk about the specific idea that we are about today, I just pulled in a few slides. One talks about going to the moon on a lunar cruise. And the idea is you'd fly out from Earth, go around the moon, and come back. And we are on slide 17 now. If you look at slide 18, you'll see that we can do this in different ways. We could do this from a coplanar orbit with the moon, or if we choose, we can do it from the International Space Station. But if we did it from the International Space Station, you would have fewer opportunities every month because of the precession of the station. Slide 19. Here you see how a large spacecraft can be built on the ISS and floated out. You'll see the STS in there for some comparison and scale, and how modules can be put together in close proximity with the station. Slide 20 shows you how it is coupled to station, so that you can even avoid some of the EVA associated with this buildup. Slide 21 shows you another paper from 2012 that you can pull up from this conference, and it talks about the same thing. Slide 22 shows how modules can be assembled and flown out. Slide 23 shows different possibilities of expansion. Slide 24 shows you even more elaborate articulation of that architecture complexity. And there are different things we could do. You know, it doesn't have to necessarily be human spaceflight and human space exploration. We could think about having these kinds of structures in various orbits to assist with development of factories, solar power satellites, and construction of other large space structures. Here's slide 26 now, and including going off to various deep space destinations. 27. So let's now move to a little bit about cislunar orbit. When you look in the literature, there are several possible options of exploiting the region between the Earth and the Moon that we call cislunar space. Using the gravity of the Earth and the Moon alone, we are able to execute some very, very interesting maneuvers. They include the free return, the halo orbit, which is also closely associated with the Lagrangian point. There is a whole bunch of literature on the weak stability boundary orbits and how we go about them for saving fuel. There's one called the backflip orbit that I think Chauncey and others have proposed. There are frozen orbits around the moon that have very interesting possibilities. And there is a set of cyclic orbits that we call, also call resonant orbits, that Buzz Aldrin and Terry Nock and several others have discussed in the literature extensively. Now, you all are familiar. We're going to slide 28, please. You're all familiar with the Apollo free return trajectory, I think. You know, you exit the Earth on a plane that brings you around the equatorial region of the moon and swings it back towards Earth. We call it a free return trajectory, and free return trajectories are not exclusive to the moon. It is also possible to do that around other planets, between the Earth and another planet and so on. And if I remember right, the Inspiration Mars mission that Dennis Tito and some of our colleagues talked about did talk about that, how you could use the free return trajectory. And you also know that that was the case that was employed in that interesting movie of last year, The Martian, where we employed the free return trajectory. So now if you go to slide 29, I mean, the term is good. Free return is a great term, but if you look at it a little more carefully, you'll see that it entails several maneuvers that are not really free, but if you want to trim the orbit to exactly where you want it to. And I thought all of you needed to know that, because of course many of you do, but I just wanted to be sure. So the free return trajectory is not really free. Slide 30. Now, there was a very interesting story about how we could use the moon for commercial purposes. And this happened during the Hughes mission, when the satellite got stranded when the upper stage malfunctioned. I think you all remember the story, but you'll see that I've listed a few of the articles that came out of that whole event to tell you how tricky these things are. The idea was to use the moon to save the spacecraft and put it in its proper orbit, which they were able to do. And, you know, the GS-1 satellite was sold to PanAmSat, and several variations were proposed. Let's go to slide 31. Let's go back to slide 30. This was one of the proposals to get it done the way we could have done it using less fuel consumption, but they ended up using what's on slide 31, which shows you that it is possible to use the moon to do a variety of maneuvers, to change planes, to introduce new timing parameters and change orbits. And so the moon came into the literature for the first time as being used for that purpose. And then later on, it was again used, and we only wish that the future holds this kind of orbital dynamics to make things work. Let's go to slide 32. So what exactly, now we're coming to the idea of the supersynchronous orbit. What is the supersynchronous Earth orbit? It's obviously beyond geostationary orbit, and it can be a high eccentricity orbit. And in our case, which we are about to look at now, we are looking at what we call resonant period design. It's a kind of a pseudo-cycler or a cycler. And if you go to slide 32, this was the paper that was presented at the AIAA meeting from 2 months ago. And Mehdi, a student in our studio, proposed the idea, and then we developed it over a period of time. Slide 34. So what is the resonant supersynchronous orbit? Now, this artwork was done by my daughter to show how you can time yourself so that you can resonate your orbits with that of the moon. You depart the Earth and go towards the moon, and if you time the orbit right, you can end up close to the moon four times during a lunar period of approximately 28 days. You time it for each of these supersynchronous orbits are about 7 days period. Then you're able to get close to the moon four times a month. Slide 35, please. So now, what was the rationale? I asked my students always in the concept architecture class to propose rationales. Why is it that you think you want to do something, and what is the benefit? And so in the Mobius rationale, I think the term Mobius came about because of the Mobius strip, you know, the idea that you can swing around on an infinite loop. And in the Mobius rationale, space activity is proposed as opposed to open-ended space exploration. And this is a recurring theme also in NASA circles and in the private space industry. Now, what does sustainable architecture mean? For NASA, sustainable architecture means how do you partition $20 billion per year and not go over budget on that? That is a sustainable space architecture for NASA. But a self-sustainable architecture is a feedback architecture where the revenues generated from your project are fed back in to keep it going, much like any commercial enterprise. So we must differentiate between sustainable and self-sustainable architectures. And I think businesses and commercial entities understand this much better than agencies that are funded annually, where they are bestowed with a budget every year. So revenues from missions are used to fulfill the objective. And a second rationale that was talked about in the Mobius idea was to use the ISS beyond retirement year. Now, suggested incremental approach was that we would have a phase in which we would just send some people to a lunar approach orbit. In phase two, when we have enough revenues coming back in, we would start a lunar orbit rendezvous. That is, you would go close to the moon and swing into a lunar orbit and come back. And in phase three, when we have even more established revenues and profits, we would attempt lunar landings. And again, it was imagined as a commercial idea. You are all familiar with the planes, and when you put planes down on the cislunar regime, you'll see that the space station is inclined quite a bit from the coplanar, the lunar coplanar, and the Earth coplanar regime. So now, what we are thinking is, if we can somehow bring station to something that is more bearable to lunar coplanar orbit, then this becomes a breeze. It's very easy. Otherwise, obviously, it is very delta V intensive, not undoable, but it becomes difficult. That is, we are in slide 36, guys, and moving to slide 37. So here it is, the simple field for Earth-Moon supersynchronous orbit. Goes into an orbit that has a period of 7 days, approximately. There's a perigee of 15,000 kilometers at Earth, Earth's perigee of 15,000 kilometers, and an apogee of 300,000 kilometers. Now, it seems that in those areas, we have to be careful not to enter the moon's sphere of influence. And that means we are still lagging behind or not approaching the Lagrangian point. So we are further in towards the Earth. So that is the Earth Moon supersynchronous orbit. You're going to slide 38, and here is a concept that talks about part of the concept that talks about how we might avoid tangling tangoing with the Van Allen belts, which we don't want to negotiate if we can help it. And Mady suggests that we should start to build this thing in Earth orbit and slowly spiral it up, unmanned, to the final orbit and perhaps save some fuel. And you'll see that he has included a lunar landing orbit once you approach close to the L1 area, where you have very little energy needed to make those changes happen. So what does the perigee rendezvous look like? It's in slide 39. You'll see that you have a faster transit here, and so you bring in your lunar bound payload and intercept the Mobius vehicle at perigee, and you carry on. Go to slide 40. It's a much easier maneuver at the apogee, where you transfer orbit to from the supersynchronous orbit to the lunar orbit. To a transit vehicle. And then we'll look at those essentially, the different systems that are involved. They include, let's go to slide 41, please. We have the International Space Station, if we can make it work. Otherwise, we'll still have the cislunar orbital vehicle, the tourist docking capsule, a cislunar propulsion system, a lunar transit lounge, a lander, and perhaps at a later phase, lunar surface facility. 42. These are the Mobius elements that are proposed. We can use the Orion, Dragon, or even the New Glenn launchers to take us up to Earth orbit. And then we would use an upper stage to fly from Earth orbit to the moon. Using the most beautiful habitat that you'll see in the next slide. And then you'll have a lunar transit lounge and a lunar lander. These are mainly the elements, except for this beautiful thing that Mady did, which is called the Earth-Moon Transit Orbit Habitat. He thinks people can go in there, several people can go in there, and here you see the Orion vehicle docking to the habitat and transferring people there, after which the injection is done by the translunar injection is initiated by the upper stage. Slide 44. Now, he thinks that the Bigelow BA-330 could be the reference for such a spacious habitat to make everybody comfortable, scientists and paying passengers alike. And Bob Bigelow is working on larger and more versatile and more spacious modules as well. 45, an interior shows a very simple idea what it could be, a schematic, how you could see. Now, what I like most about it is that EVA cage on the left side, where crew or paying passengers can don a spacesuit and get out there and really feel like they're floating in EVA in a constrained and safe environment. So let's go to 46. Some slides that show you various ideas about the various parts of the sequence of operations. 46, 47 shows a departure. 48 shows another departure scene. 49 shows the capsule docking with the COV. 50 shows capsule is docked with the COV. And 51 shows the injection burn about to happen. 52 is another one. You know, I keep telling them I want to see beautiful pictures, and they really deliver sometimes. On its way to the moon, on 52. And 53 shows the vehicle approaching the lunar transit lounge. 54 shows the transit lounge also. And 55 talks about some of the merits, about making this a commercial operation, and how a free return trajectory could be useful if there is an injection anomaly or a propulsion burn problem. Merits and limitations include it's an evolutionary phased approach, much like Yesko von Furtkamer and others from NASA mentioned in the early 60s. Requires a little bit of station keeping because of precession. And plane changes are hard, but, you know, it is something that can be done. And perhaps if the ISS is not on the critical path, we can do this from a lunar coplanar orbit from the start as well. And Van Allen belts are tricky to negotiate. We know that. We go to slide 57. There's another pretty picture of the upper stage injecting the vehicle off to destination. Now, I want to spend 1 minute, please, on slide 58. Now, this is the most recent version of NASA's plan to get from Earth to Mars. If you notice very carefully, you will see the Earth and the space station that I circled in green, which is where we are really at now. And the next destination is very clearly the circle in red, which is the moon. And again, I say this to all of us engineers, because without getting hard data back from flights, we are going to be stuck with PowerPoint charts and estimations and simulations that really will not help us to go to where we want to go, to Mars and beyond. And so it's very, very critical now, I think, that the administration really weighs priorities and think about getting us some hard data back on vehicles and systems operating in the cislunar and lunar surface regime. It's not just me. It's all the NASA reports that are saying this. So with that, I will conclude by acknowledging Mehdi Lali, who is a great graduate student. He's looking for PhD opportunities all over the country. So please connect with him and talk to him about it. Mehdi likes orbital dynamics a lot and enjoys his education at USC, where he has also applied for the graduate program. And I hope to be connecting with Mehdi about it. And please look up our team project from last year where he proposed this. There are several slides I pulled that you would like to look at that he elaborates this on. Mehdi writes very interesting prose. I would like you to look at that paper too, if you get the chance, on Mobius, which is probably out on the AIAA archives. With that, I will conclude with the references. Please go take a look at the references in that paper. And also, if you get a chance, look at what goes on behind a creative endeavor once it has had success. And you'll see the debates that raged after the huge rescue mission. I've probably put those references in there as well. Thank you very much. And I'm ready for questions.
Great, Madhu. Thanks so much. And the moderator, that is me, the moderator's prerogative, I'd like to ask you the first question. And so my apologies. I just mentioned the new engineers and scientists down the hall. I went down the hall to make sure that they, for a couple of minutes, to see if they were okay. So I may have missed the following if you mentioned it. You closed by noting, making a very useful suggestion about acquiring data in the vicinity of the moon, the libration, whatever, in the vicinity, if we're going to send humans there on the way to Mars. Very good suggestion. Did you mention in the middle part of your presentation, the part that I missed, what are the recommended measurements, findings, whatever, in that region in space?
Well, it's very clearly, the data coming down from the ISS, particularly in radiation, is not quite useful for destinations beyond the Van Allen Belt. And this I say because the species, the energies, and in fact, the whole environment is suspect. And, you know, if you look at the charts that they brought out by the MSL during transit and during Mars surface activity, that kind of tells you what kind of energies can come about and how they spike over the transit period. There were some spikes, but are they dangerous? And my answer is we don't know. We have to be cautious. We have to err on the side of caution before putting our brave and very bright astronauts in that regime. And the way to do that is to fly in cislunar space beyond the Earth's magnetic field, the Harley.
A good suggestion. So you know, we've had FISO talks about this in the not distant past about the dangers of radiation and countermeasures and so on. So you make a very good point. A significant fraction of NASA and of course other agency missions between here and Mars and of course elsewhere, LEO, GEO, and so on, carry particle radiation detectors for that reason, among others. So your point has been taken very seriously, but I'm glad you've emphasized it again. Go ahead, Madhu.
And the second issue, Harley, is partial gravity. Now, you know, it's very clear, at least from the data that we have got, that I've seen, you know, zero free fall, zero gravity, it cannot be anymore an excuse for flying long duration missions. I think we need to have artificial gravity. I'm happy that it has entered NASA discussions in a serious way now. And I also think that transit is one part of the equation, but surface activity is another. And the artificial gravity, the way we proposed by tethering and so on, is not the same as surface gravity, partial surface gravity. And I think we should pay attention to the fact that the moon, which is so close to us, gives you a yes or a no in partial gravity, because if you can do things in 1/6 G, 1/6 real G, none of the spinning stuff, 1/6 real G, I think you'll get a very clear yes or no whether humans can happily do things in extended duration on Mars or on other planets.
Sounds good. All right. Do other folks have questions? Other questions from the participants?
Marty, this is Ted Sweetser at JPL.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you could go over slide 34, because I was puzzled by that. I don't think you were saying the orbit would progress its line of apsides that fast, but I'm not sure what it is showing.
Let me go to slide 34. We took some creative license here, the artistry. But your question again?
Just to understand what the slide is showing, I guess you're recommending or proposing having four different cislunar orbits that you could pick and choose among?
Well, what we have here really is the light blue is the supersynchronous orbit, Earth orbit. And that is the main thing we want to show in that image, to show the various times that the Earth and the Moon would be in the right spot for transfers.
I guess I don't understand. Is it a supersynchronous orbit like that cannot progress around the Earth the way it's shown here, not in any reasonable time? I mean, the line of apsides cannot rotate that fast.
Yeah, I suppose this is something that that we have to.
Wait, the way I read the chart, there are four different orbits that are used, not one that rotates, but four different ones. The quartet of resonant orbits.
Yeah, that's what I wondered.
I think the way we want it to work is to time that and to make the line of apsides work for us. So obviously there are some corrections to be done, right?
Well, it's just a little confusing is all. I'm not sure what's really being proposed. If it's separate orbits and you have, say, a fleet of orbiters out there so that you can do like a fleet of airliners going from city to city at various times, then there's no restriction to being just the four points of the orbit. You could orient them however you'd want.
Yeah, I think we have to redraw this so that we get the idea how this happens, because there are several places, there are several times when you don't have the opportunity to be close to the Moon. Is that what you're saying?
I guess I'm just puzzled by the multiplicity of the orbits.
Please help us to visualize it. But do you get the idea of what it is that we want to do?
If you're talking about what was shown on slide 37, yes.
Uh-huh.
I think that's a more straightforward picture.
Okay. Good. We'll study that more. But I'm glad that you brought that up.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Good point. We're just about a minute before we normally quit, although we do have this line for 24/7. So if there are other questions and Mahu can stay, please ask them.
I'm happy to engage. And do they have our email, Harley? Do they have my email?
Good. Good question. I'd have to go back and take a look at the invitation myself. I don't write them. Unless Dan Lester is here.
There is, we have an invite, sheet, that you can download that gives your bio. And, on that bio, your email address is there. So everybody has your email if they want it.
Okay. Good. Great.
Great. Great. Thanks, Dan.
Any other,
other questions? Other questions? Okay, great. Thank you all. Thanks, everybody. Good presentation. Thank you, Madhu.
Thanks.
Finished up right on time. Time for questions. Oh, you have something else to add, Madhu?
The only thing is that, you know, with the new administration coming in, I really hope that they pay attention to the logical and quick way to execute ambitious missions. You know, we really need that. You know, we really need that new impetus. And I have a feeling that it's coming, Harley and Dan. And thank you for hosting me on this talk.
And thank you for being hosted. So talk to you, and I hope, Madhu, you'll be joining us in the future in our audience. So, again, thank you, everybody, and talk to you next Wednesday.